Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, today, my special guest is Reverend Leroy Lowell. He is a Unity minister. He is 38 years clean and sober, and 4 years ago he did a men's rights passage, and short and sweet he is, for the past 3 years he's been exploring nature and the human soul, and nature as the first Bible. And so I'd like to introduce Reverend Leroy. Leroy, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful today. I'm doing wonderful
Great.
Today, David.
Pardon me?
I said, it's a great sunny day up here in Maine. We've had a lot of rain, so it's nice to have a nice sunny day.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, we have an overcast day here, but the temperatures are very moderate, very comfortable to be outside in your shirt sleeves. Mm-hmm. The humidity's low, so I have somebody doing grunt work in my garden. I have a cleaning lady who likes to work in the dirt, too, and she's taking care of something that I don't like to do, and that's pulling weeds. So I'm grateful for that. I get to sit here in the comfort of my office and do this radio show, which I so enjoy, and thank you for being my guest today. It's an honor to have you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Well, I'd like to start off just asking what your family of origin was like.
My family of origin was, I was born and brought up on an island off the coast of Maine, population of about 60 families, and my father was a fisherman, and my mother always worked, so it was a family, they had their difficulties, I grew up in a Methodist church, but my father and mother had, my father had difficulty with alcohol, and they both had difficulty with fidelity and infidelity. So, and there was a lot of fight. There was a lot of fighting in my childhood family between my parents. It was a pretty scary place at times.
Yeah. Well, that certainly can be scary for a child and confusing, too. Mm-hmm. So there was dysfunction in your family. Was there any trauma for you as a child?
I didn't quite get the question.
I just wondered if there was any other trauma for you as a child that mm-hmm. affected you at a core level.
As a 12-year-old, my sister had a stroke, and
mm-hmm.
and that affected because it made the responsibility, me having the responsibility for my sister. My mother had told me that, you know, we have to be careful. We have to watch out for Nita because this could always happen again. And so it was a long drawn out thing. And it's just been it's been within the past year that I've healed. I think that I've healed that resentment that I had. I did a lot of work on it, and I said it was healed until my sister is battling with cancer right now. And I have come to the place of, if need be, and if it is a, if it's an end of life thing, of bringing her to live with me so that I can help her making that next step, final crossing. So it's like a replay, and I didn't say it earlier, but my parents did get divorced when I was 8 or 9, and my father took off when I was 10, and I didn't see him again for 8 or 10 years, and was very difficult. That was very difficult as part of my childhood.
I'm sure it was. Well, I was interested in hearing the story about your sister and how you've overcome that resentment. It reminded me of the biblical scripture where Jesus says that we need to forgive not 7 times, but 70 times 7 times. And it's such a process to get rid of resentments and to forgive others and to forgive ourselves. So, you know, good for you that you've healed from that, and I'm sure there'll be additional healing ahead for you. At least I pray there will be.
Mm-hmm. That's what, go ahead.
No, you go.
No, what I was gonna say, and that's what's, that's one of the things that I've been, you know, that's, forgiveness is a hard thing, but it's a necessity. It's a real necessity, mm-hmm. and, that's what started me on a spiritual journey, was the calling that Jesus made and in forgiving them and how he went about it.
Mm.
I sometimes say that what people, if I was doing a men's retreat, I was a retreat director for men's retreat. I spent 5 or 6 years ago now, and the topic come up of religion, what religion you was. And I said, I don't know that I'm a Christian because of what, if you, the definition that most people have of a Christian, I know that I'm not. But mm-hmm. I know one thing for sure is that I'm a radical disciple of Jesus Christ. And that meaning that the forgiveness has to come to the place of when the guy's got the gun in your face saying, I forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do.
Right. And what a powerful statement that was, coming from a man who was suffering so. And, you know, I can imagine very few people in that position would have been able to forgive their perpetrators.
Definitely.
I'd like to ask you, what was your early concept of God?
My early concept of God was kind of a guy sitting on a throne,
mm-hmm.
taking judgments. I mean, I thought I got that in the Methodist church that I went to, but I went back to the Methodist church years later, after I had a transformational experience in my life, and they were speaking about love. They were speaking about a loving God. So it seemed I always had the picture that the minister was always pointing at me, and that mm-hmm. I was the one that was going to go straight to hell.
Right.
And I,
well,
and
you
I
know,
had that,
90, go ahead.
Yeah. And it was just something that I carried. But there was some level, that was my conception as young, but at some level, there was something about the Jesus that I was introduced to in Sunday school that I always had a connection to.
I can relate to that. You know, what I was going to say is that over 90% of the guests that I've had on the show, their early concept of God was one of a God of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And that invoked a lot of fear of punishment, a lot of judgment around them being quote-unquote sinners. So mm-hmm. I think that's very interesting, and it's very nice to hear that Latter-day messages from the church speak more of the God of love. So how has your concept of God evolved over the years?
Well, I guess the best way to I started in some 12-step recovery 30-something years ago, and mm-hmm. And that was what started changing my concept of God to the point that I got to the steps around. I could come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, but I didn't believe that that power would restore me to sanity. I still felt the judgment, and I was hunting up in the northern neck of Virginia, and I had taken a couple of I was reading Science of Mind magazine at the time, and I took my I had my Science of Mind book and the Science of Mind magazine, and I found me a place on the side of a ridge looking down into a gully, and I read the Daily Meditation and from the Science of the Mind book, and I was just kind of sitting there and halfway in meditation, halfway in just thinking, and the whole side of the other side of the gully lit up and the light come down and engulfed me, and I heard or sensed the words that you are my son and I love you.
Oh.
And it's been from that time since that it's really been about a loving God for me.
Mm, that's great.
And that was the real shift. That was the shift from, before I got into 12-step recovery, I knew that I had some difficulty, and I was looking for an answer in churches. And every church that I went to said that I don't know what they said, but the way I read it was that if you don't believe exactly the way we believe, you're going to go straight to a chute to hell.
Mm-hmm,
and
and
the Jesus that I learned about in Sunday school couldn't be like that.
Right.
And I kept looking, and when I found my place in a 12-step recovery group, and they said that it was a God of your understanding, that helped me to start the work that I had to do to have that spiritual experience.
Well, that raises a question. Certainly, I've heard many people proclaim that if you don't embrace Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, that you are not going to enter the kingdom of heaven. What is your feeling about the validity of other religions and spiritual practices?
Well, to make it real short, as I believe that there is one God and there's many paths to that one God.
Same here.
When I was in ministerial training, my chaplaincy training is I had a nursing home, and I had a patient that was an Alzheimer's patient, and I used to go and visit her, like I think it was once a week that we went in and made our calls on them and everything, and she was a real, from a real evangelical, hardcore Christian church upbringing, but she would look at me with a smile on her face, and she says, you know, just because they live in the wilderness somewhere and never heard about Jesus, I don't believe they're going to go to hell. I believe they're going to go to heaven right with everybody else. And that's what,
right.
And that's the belief. It's about I use Jesus as my teacher, as my way shower. He's my guru. I look at Jesus as my guru. And I try to practice his teachings to the best of my ability, and doing that. And sometimes I miss it. I miss it by a wide shot sometimes, but I'm a lot different now than I was when I started on this journey.
Mm.
I'm gentler. I'm more loving. I'm more compassionate. I know that. I know that for two or three reasons. One thing, reason is people that knew me before and know me now tell me that quite regular.
Nice. Well, that seems to be the way it works. I know that was the kind of feedback I got because I couldn't see the changes that were taking place. But other people would say things in the beginning, they would say things like, I don't know who you are. And I'd say, what do you mean? And you're not the same person that I knew. And that confused me, but I understand what that's about now. And for me, the whole journey has been about unlearning almost everything that I thought I knew, because to me, spiritual truths are the polar opposite of anything that the ego can concoct.
And so
I had to retrain myself to do the opposite thing. And ultimately, it all came down to just following the pathway of love. I believe that we don't need any other of the Ten Commandments other than to practice the Golden Rule. And if we can do that, then we are living a life based on love. What do you think?
That's the bottom line. We call it love, compassion. I have never seen hate overcome love. I've never heard of that. You know, I remember, it's been a few years ago, but the story was about a person that was a Course in Miracles person, and her daughter got killed in an automobile accident. And the young man that killed her had stolen a car, and what they found out, this person was a Course in Miracles student, and what she found out is that because of their own lack of forgiveness, their whole marriage and everything was going to pieces. The whole family was going to pieces. And she was able to step forward and connect with this young man and actually do the forgiveness work, even to the point that I think, and I don't know, I'm not exactly sure, but to the point that they kept him from doing hard time in jail and started working with him. And her and this young man now, I don't know if they still do, but used to tour around doing presentations in schools and such about teenagers and about drunken driving and about the power of forgiveness.
When she was coming from
that place of anger, her life had stopped working. And the freedom came when she was able to do the forgiveness work.
And that's all spirit versus ego.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah.
And there was
Go ahead.
There used to be a story, and I don't know that I think I read it in one of the worst books, and it was about in the early days of Unity when it was up on Tracy Street in Kansas City. It wasn't a real good neighborhood, and this older woman was coming from walking home from a class, and a mugger came up to mug her and said, give me your pocketbook, and she just looked at him and said, son, I love you.
He said,
you don't understand. If you don't give me your pocketbook, I'm going to shoot you. And she says, you don't understand, son, I love you. And he dropped his gun and ran. He couldn't.
Wow.
I mean, so, you know, those are the stories that I've heard, and I believe that they're true.
I do, too.
In my experience, before I got into 12-step recovery, I was pretty wild, and I was a fighter, and this is early in my recovery. I was in a situation, and a guy that I used to know before I got sober, before I got clean, we were clean together. And in this situation, I knew that there was a woman involved, and I knew that he wanted to jump up and just beat me up. And I sat there on the floor and prayed that I wouldn't fight back. And nothing ever came of it. We were able to get through it. And that was the first time that I practiced that, that I literally practiced that, that I practiced not fighting instead of fighting.
Well, you know, in 12-step programs, they say fake it until you make it. And for me, what that's translated to is that I've had to try on new behaviors that felt alien to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they became automatic because I had to learn a whole new way of thinking and being that involved making healthy decisions for myself.
And that's what I have. I mean, if I look at that, that fake it if you make it, it's almost like fake it until I make it is stepping out in faith. I'm going to go and do this practice on faith that's going to work.
Yes.
But I had to
yes,
get tripped
absolutely.
Into If they had told me early in that recovery process that I'd have to do it on faith, that would have sent me right over the wall.
right. Well, I want to back up a little bit. You were talking about a situation that some people might perceive as bad with the guy that came up and said he was going to shoot the woman if she didn't give him his pocketbook.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been intrigued by the words good and bad, and I've come mm-hmm. to believe that there is only good, that God is all good, that everything is all good, and that when you look at things as good or bad, that you're casting a judgment. What do you think?
I believe that. I still catch myself doing that, but I certainly
mm-hmm.
believe that. I certainly
okay.
believe that. And it's at a point where some work that I've been doing in the past year or so, the soul work that I've been doing, I've been looking at sacred wounds, at the wounds that we've had, and see them as sacred wounds. And to speak in one of them is the my daughter passed at 16 from lupus.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh.
And I when she was diagnosed and everything, I struggled with that. And to me, that was bad. At the time, that was bad. But what I, through the process, and now in question after it, in hindsight, I can see where there was, that was, not to sound Pollyannish, but I can see where my daughter came to teach me lessons about grieving and about love. And through the process, I believe that she learned her lesson that she had to learn on crossing mm-hmm. to the other side. And I learned the lesson that we had to learn about letting go of someone that crosses to the other side.
Mm-hmm. There is always a lesson in everything. And
yes.
I believe that before we come into this life, that we choose those challenges that we want to overcome. And we choose the people that we want to incarnate with and
mm-hmm.
to have mutual experiences that enhance one another or that can enhance one another because some people never get it quote-unquote right.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I brought up that good and bad thing is, I don't know if you can relate to this, but I used to be very rigid in my thinking and things were black and white, good and bad, and there was no color in between, and I've come to embrace the whole spectrum of color, and with it I've let go of a lot of prejudices I used to have that I didn't even realize I had. So, I'd like to ask you, go ahead.
What I was going to say is that black and white thinking, and I say this from church a lot, is, you know, as I used to be, I used to be to the right of Genghis Khan, and I'm a little bit to the left of Teddy Kennedy now, is the thing. That's just a change. If I was in white, you know, way
Boy, those
white.
Are some extremes you got there.
Yeah, and it came from fear.
Yes, of course.
Fear started changing. As I started getting less fearful, I became mm-hmm. I didn't see so much. My color spectrum started widening, so that I could see the color, so that I was more, I was okay with who I was, and I didn't have to point at anybody else.
Well, fear comes from the ego. And the opposite of fear is love, which comes from spirit. I mean, Course in Miracles teaches that. One of the great mystical Jesuits that I've embraced is one of my favorite writers, Anthony DeMello, talked about that too, that there are only two conditions, fear and love, and anything that's not love stems from fear.
Amen.
So, yeah. Well, let me ask you, how and when did you become drawn to be a minister, and why did you choose Unity?
Well, I can say it was a childhood dream. I had a childhood dream of it someday being, there's two things that I had dreams of, was being a Marine engineer and being an ordained minister. And I didn't do well academically in school, so I thought all of that was lost. And I ended up going to the Navy, made a career in the Navy. And when I got clean and sober, I used my Navy SEA time and set up my second engineer's license and became a Marine engineer. And I was, and I knew in my recovery process, I knew that I wanted to help others. And I almost became an addiction counselor. That didn't work, and I got retired from the Navy, sailed in the Merchant Marines, and was still drawn to, you know, to spirit. I really was continually drawn to spiritual aspects. I got introduced to Unity early in my process, and I loved Unity's teaching, and the openness of it.
Let's talk about what's unique about the teachings of Unity. And I'm sorry for the interruption. This is the problem when you're doing live radio over the telephone like this. You can't see when the other person might be about to say something else.
Well, and I'll go to that. And this was, I got connected to Unity in my first year or so of my recovery process. I had been connected up to into a an evangelical church, and I just couldn't buy the theology. I got to the place where I couldn't buy the theology, and a friend of mine asked me to go to her church with her, and it was Unity of Tidewater, and they walked in and they used the Christ salute, the Christ in me, greets the Christ in you, and together may we work for the glory of God. And I knew that I was, that saying made me feel, I felt at home. I felt at home. The way that I felt at home when I walked into this 12-step recovery room with the aspect of one God, of your own conception of God, when I walked into Unity, I felt at home. And I learned that they taught. I had been a student of Emmett Fox's at the time, especially Sermon on the Mount, of Emmett Fox's teaching on Sermon on the Mount.
Oh, I love that book, Sermon on the Mount. That's wonderful.
And Unity was right in line with that. And I just my first Unity book was a book by Eric Butterworth that isn't in print anymore. And it was Life is for Loving. I think it was Life is for Loving. I think that was the name of it. And at the time, I had such difficulty with what love was. And it sung to me and spoke to me and helped me to understand that at a deeper level. And I just continued to get active in Unity. When I went to sea in the Merchant Marines, Unity used to have a book and tape club, and I did send book reports and tape reports out once a month, and you could order the books or the tapes, and I got their tapes and their books, and was very involved in Unity, and I liked the aspect of it of Jesus coming here to teach us how to do what he did, not that he came here to be crucified for our sins.
Mm-hmm.
he came here as a elder brother and way shower to teach us how to, and the aspect that each one of us has the spark of divinity in us, that rang to me. I knew that to be the truth. There was something about that in me, I knew that to be the truth. And I never was active in a church at the time because I was going to sea for a living. And in 1990, I had a heart attack, and that changed. That was another spiritual experience for me. And while I was in an intensive care unit, I made a covenant with God that the rest of my life would be about raising my consciousness to that of the Christ and the planet's consciousness to that of the Christ. And when I got out, I got active in a unity church, and the rest is history. I didn't think I could get into Unity's ministerial program because I didn't have the IE formal education, and I made it. I got accepted in the ministerial program, and that was 95, and I went in, and I went in the training program and was ordained in 1997.
Let's talk about consciousness raising.
Okay.
It sounds to me as if you believe one person can make an impact on the consciousness of all. Is that true?
Yes, most definitely. Most definitely.
And how do you see that happening?
I see us being connected. I see us as humankind. Not just humankind, as all living beings on Earth and the Earth being connected at some level. And everything that I do to better myself and raise my consciousness and my awareness up has an effect on everybody else's.
And how does it do that?
I don't know exactly how it does that, but I believe that it does that. I believe it's that group stuff. I believe if you get in a group and the group can get changed just by the consciousness of a few of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And end up changing the whole consciousness. I know that when people, all I can just say is this: in the past year, I went through a year-long process. Part of the process was a vision fast, was a vision quest, and something happened in me when I did that, and I took my son to lunch, and I divorced my son's mother 37 years ago, and when we went, I took him to lunch for his birthday just this past year. And he was able to finally ask me if there was anything that I did in my early recovery that I regretted, and i.e. that was divorce, that I would have done different.
Mm-hmm.
And what that was is he was asking me if I had any second thoughts about divorcing his mother.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't been able to ask me that before. So something happened. In that vision fast, something happened in my energy field that affected him when I came near him.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's,
I think,
amazing
that's
how that works.
Now you asked, and your question was, how do we, by raising our consciousness, affect other people? And it's because of the energy that our body radiates.
Right.
It affects around us.
Well, we live in a vibrational universe, as Esther Hicks would say, and there's a law of attraction, this is my belief, that corresponds to the energy that we put out. And we put out positive energy. We attract positive experiences and people and things into our lives. And when we put out negative energy, the converse is true.
That's in a nutshell. I mean, that's my whole belief system. I don't, this past winter, is the first winner since I was 12 or 13 years old that I've had any kind of sickness. And my thing has always been, part of it, I guess I'm getting older, but part of it too is whenever somebody says, oh, it's going around, I will always say, it's not going around my house.
Mm-hmm.
And I backed off of doing something. I let it get around my house this winter.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed is I got into a place, and because I had some sickness through the winter, I get into a place of thinking, worrying about the sickness, and I just kept getting more of it up until just this past month. Up until this past month, and it's come clear to me that by getting into that place and being on my pity pot about having the one cold, that bronchitis, and then the shingles, and then this, and then that, and when I stopped doing that, it slowed down on what was going on with me, and I start feeling better, and I start feeling. So.
That's a good lesson to us all, and something very difficult, I think, to put into practice when somebody is struck with a really chronic or life-threatening condition. I've known people that have been pronounced terminally ill who've been able to turn that around and heal themselves through grace. Now, you have remarried, and you're married to a Unity minister.
Yes.
What kind of challenges has that brought into your life?
That hasn't brought any challenges.
Great.
I don't know how to say this. This is both of our third time around.
Uh-huh.
And we met at the Unity Church that I went to after I had my heart attack in 1990, and we were doing classes, and we met in a meditation group at the church. There's a Lenten meditation that ended up going from the beginning of Lent till after November that met at 7 a.m. every morning. And we met there. And the reason I can say that it's been great is because the principles have been a part of our relationship since we got together. My stuff from 12-step recovery, and now her stuff from 12-step recovery, has we use those principles within our relationship, and we give time every morning. We give an hour to 2 hours every morning to stuff that supports our relationship.
Wonderful.
And since she was ordained a year before me. And since we've been in ministry, we've been co-ministers any place we've been. We've been able to work together. And the only reason that I know that it works is because we've used the principles in our relationship. I can't say that enough. We haven't been afraid to say when we've been wrong and make amends for it.
That's wonderful.
Go ahead.
What would you say to someone who's searching for God?
I would say, stop searching.
Mm.
Start just in the silence. I would tell them. I would say, have you tried looking out in nature?
Mm.
Have you tried going out and sitting in nature? And just being aware of the life around you in nature. Because so many of us think that God, we have to find God in a church somewhere, but God is everywhere. If we could see God in especially in nature, I mean, it's so much around us, and it doesn't have to be in nature, but I would say, you know, that would be a good place to start. And I say that because I have, every time prayer and meditation comes up in one of my 12-step meetings, there's always somebody that says, you know, I have a hard time with God. I have to go out and get in nature. And then I just, and nature, and God is there.
Mm-hmm.
If, God is everywhere.
I think that's a wonderful place to start.
Mm-hmm.
I was sorry to move you on, but there's a significant area that I want to get into, and that is your addiction story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the power of sharing one's experience, strength, and hope is just an amazing thing to be able to transfer to other people who are open to receiving the message. And before we do that, I'd like to just take a commercial break to advertise my latest book, Shades of Gay by David Clark, which is a recovery story. So if you'll bear with me for a minute, we have a one-minute commercial.
Prepare to be shocked. Prepare to be moved. Prepare to laugh. Prepare to cry. And prepare to be inspired. Dive into David Clark's latest book, Shades of Gay, and you will find yourself plunged into the trenches of sexual addiction. You will embark upon a kaleidoscopic tour from the abyss to higher ground. In the beginning, it was love at first sight when Daniel and Mark met, but through the years, that same love became tainted. Daniel, an alcoholic and sex addict, has found himself unable to resist the lure of other men. When Mark discovers his infidelity, he leaves Daniel, who begins a dark descent into sexual tryst after tryst. Shades of Gay reveals the myriad desires a lost man can permit his body and soul to revel in despite the pain they bring. But can such fleeting moments of pleasure bring meaning to life? Will Daniel realize the love he had with Mark is worth more than the sweat spent in other men's beds?
Mm-hmm. And that book is available on Amazon.com. And again, it's Shades of Gay. And you need to put in my name, David Clark, because there are multiple books with the same title. So let's talk a little bit about your 12-step story. Would you be willing to disclose the addictions that you're recovering from?
Yes, yes, I can do that. I started the first one up for me was alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that alcohol. And then I went from I surrendered to alcohol and I kept in the back of my mind that I probably could smoke a joint or take a pill or something to get a few more hours out of the day. And I got sober in June, and on Labor Day weekend I was at a party. We was on the deck, and my present wife and my wife at the time and my mother and a friend of mine that had some time sober was smoking a joint, and I let it go by, and it went dry till it was just a roach, and I hit on it, and I was in the morning took a pull on it, and I was in my wife's pocketbook digging out another joint. And what happened is I went back into the dance, and she didn't want to dance, and I got real nasty. I had the same Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that alcohol did, and my friend that was with us was able to get me out of the place. And the next morning I asked to be clean and sober. And then from that, it went from my next addiction was my sex and love addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had been a sexual victim my whole life. It didn't make a difference, men, women, whatever. If anybody approached me sexually, it was, here I am. You know, I'm all yours. And it got to the point that through my drinking and stuff, I was always chasing it. And it was in my second marriage. It was in recovery. I had an 18-year-old adopted daughter, and I was peeping on her, and I knew that I had to do something. And I went to the Karen Foundation for ACOA treatment, and the sex stuff came up, and I got into Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And I've been maintaining the bottom line in that addiction since 1978.
Wow, that's wonderful. I wish I could say the same. I share both of those addictions.
Mm.
And I don't know if this resonates for you, but I found that, not to diminish the fact that recovery from alcohol was a challenge, recovery from sex addiction was a struggle for me. And what I've since come to realize, and it was so much more difficult, because it wasn't like just putting down a substance, but what I've come to realize is that when I reframe a struggle into a challenge, challenges I can overcome. Struggles, I'm lost.
Exactly.
So I don't know what you feel about that.
I just know that when I started, I knew that physical abstinence had to be there before any emotional abstinence, right, that could come. And I set a fairly easy, I set a bottom line that I could maintain. I burned all my sex toys. I think it was 87, actually. I burned all my sex toys and all my pornography and all of that stuff at that time. And I haven't done any pornography, and I haven't played with any sex toys, anything since that time.
Mm.
You know, and I haven't, and I can say that I've been, I haven't practiced emotional infidelity either since that time.
Mm-hmm.
And but now, what I did do was I was smoking about 4-pack cigarettes a day, though.
Oh.
I was smoking about 4 packs of cigarettes a day, and drinking unknown cups of coffee, you know, and working.
Uh huh. Yeah.
And working ungodly hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what had happened is now I cleaned up my alcohol, I cleaned up my drugs,
mm-hmm.
I cleaned up sex, and now I'm using cigarettes in work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the heart attack that got me off the cigarettes and got me really off of the work addiction too.
Well, it's amazing when you push down one peg, another one seems to pop up.
Most definitely.
You know,
most definitely.
I struggle with eating today.
I struggle with eating today. I'm not a beastly overweight, but I struggle with it. You know, my weight goes.
Anthony DeMello says that to be human is to be addicted, and I apologize for talking over you.
But,
and I think it's because, you know, we attach ourselves to people, places, and things.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in this material mm-hmm. world, and Jesus spoke to us about that, about how we needed to let go. And that ultimately is the challenge for all of us, I believe. I can only speak for myself, but I have had to carefully examine all of the things that I've used to attach myself to make myself feel better, that ultimately has not worked, because the only thing that fills that great void within me is spirit or God. And, you know, it all boils down to people, places, and things for me, as they said in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
I need to focus on what is positive and let go of that which is not.
Yep. You know, one of the work that I've been doing for the past year or so started with the rites of passage that I went through, and then I got involved in some work by Bill Pluck and Soulcraft and his work there, and it's got me more into ecology and deep ecology, and you know, and it's the industrial growth society that has us, that have made us get so attached to everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the process. And I think that we're coming to a place where that's going to stop working.
I hope
and
so.
And we got to know how to bring about a life-sustaining society.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is breaking down from that. And I think we're just a mini of that. And when I've heard you share what you've gone through, and I know what I've gone through, and it's like a place where it started breaking down, and I've had to start being life, but I had to stop practicing life sustaining practices within myself.
Do you believe that once an addict, always an addict?
Yes, I do. And do I believe that healing can take place? I believe that healings can take place.
Yes.
It's real. Well, I know it sounds double. I still identify myself. My main identity is with alcohol, and I still
okay.
And I still identify myself as an alcoholic. And I'll say, if there was a drug today that could make me immune to the addictive effects of alcohol, I can say right now, I would hope this to be true, I wouldn't want to use it.
Because
I don't want to alter my consciousness. So in that aspect, I'm healed because I don't want to alter my consciousness. Now, could something get? Well, yes. I had the most painful experience in my friggin' life this winter with shingles, and to the point that I had to take some narcotic type pain medication. But I did not have to overuse the pain medication, even though it was very painful waiting, but I made sure that I waited until the time that it was due. So that's the difference. This is the kid that before recovery, if the doctor gave me a script that said take 2 every 4 hours, I'd take 4 every 2 hours because it worked better.
Right.
So something is changing. So there's the healings, and if I'm healed from alcoholism, why would I want to drink?
Right.
I never drank because I liked the taste of it. I always drank because I wanted the effect of it.
Right. Same here.
Yeah.
Well,
but so I know that's mealy mouth
I don't think it is at all, because I think it's just one of those paradoxes in life. And, of course, Jesus accomplished healings. I believe in what is said in the Bible around his healings. I take it literally. Most of the Bible I interpret metaphorically, but I take that literally. And I believe we can heal ourselves because we are part of God. And God can work absolute miracles within our lives. And, you know, I hear amazing stories of people that have been cured of this, that, or the other thing. But another interesting thing that Esther Hicks, and I like her very much. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she channels
Abraham.
A little bit,
but not.
Well, she talks about
Esther and
the law
Jerry,
of attraction. Pardon?
It's Esther and Jerry, isn't it?
Correct.
Jerry
is now deceased. Jerry's passed.
Okay,
but,
I didn't know.
Esther's the one that channels, and Jerry was like the spokesperson and promoter. And Esther once had an alcoholic in her audience identify himself as such, and she questioned him about using that label. She doesn't believe in labels. She believes they're limiting, and I do too. But I can see the benefit of using that label in the context of a 12-step meeting, because there's so many people in early recovery that have got so much denial to overcome. And that's the only reason I call myself an alcoholic, because quite frankly, I believe I've recovered from that disease. But, you know, I understand it. And actually, I usually call myself a recovering alcoholic. Now, when it comes to sexual addiction, I will not identify myself as a sex addict. I say I'm sexually sober today. I believe that I am is the most powerful statement in the universe, and that I need to connect it only to things that are affirming. and nothing that is disaffirming or that diminishes me in any way. And that's not to say that being a sex addict was a bad thing, because I don't want to cast a judgment on it. It's brought me to my today. However, it's the limiting thing, and mm-hmm. I am spiritually unlimited, so I will not wear that label. What do you think about that?
I agree with that. I agree with that, and I struggle. I want to change it, even in an AA meeting, because I just do. I mean, when it's about attaching the I am to it, and I don't feel that by attaching the I am to it, I want to change that, but it's not. And Stretton Smith in 4T's always said that when he identified himself, he always identified himself, "Hello, my name's Stretton, and Stretton is an alcoholic."
Ah.
He didn't attach the I am to it. And I've tried to do that, and I've been, I mean, I think, I, you know, it's been 20 years ago or so or more that I, 20 years ago that I got, that I've not, since I've been introduced to Stretton Smith's 4T's, and I've heard him saying that, and I'm still going, when I identify myself in an AA meeting, I said, I am a happy, grateful alcoholic, you know. But I would like to be able to change that way, just that the I am of me is pure. The I am of me is pure spirit. But Leroy has a little bit of difficulty with alcohol and with sugar right now, but don't have active difficulty with alcohol, and I have active difficulty with sugar.
Well, I have active difficulty with nicotine today.
Okay. Yep.
And I've let go of that so many times in my life, and I've kidded myself in thinking that I could have just one, and within a week I was a full-blown nicotine addict again. So that's the next addiction. That's the second most difficult addiction for me to deal with, and sexual addiction has been the granddaddy of my addictions. But I would just, we're running out of time. I would just like you to share what your greatest challenges and greatest triumphs are. If you could do that in about 2 minutes, that would be great. And what your vision for yourself is.
Okay. My greatest challenge was the loss of a child. That was my greatest pain and my greatest challenge. I just was doing some reflecting a month ago sometime, and I have completed all of my childhood dreams.
Right.
I dreamt of, it was being a minister, being a marine engineer, living back mm-hmm. in Maine, in the woods somewhere in Maine, being mm-hmm. a lobster fisherman, and I've done all of those things. And now I'm on a path, and that has taken me through doing a year-long soul, diving into soul. And to me, that was the piece that was missing. That was the piece that was missing from unity. It was about going down and getting in touch with the soul and with into the depths of the psyche and doing that through nature, and doing a vision fast, doing a 4 days fast and a 4 days solo in a vision fast was big time stuff for me. And what came of that was the continued vision of raising my consciousness to that of the Christ, and raising the planet's consciousness to that of the Christ, and having a spiritual community that had at least a kindergarten to grade 12 school that taught ecology, that taught spiritual, all the different spiritual disciplines, and had self-sustaining, had life-sustaining lessons that it taught, and had its sustaining own sustaining farm, and was putting this out, how we could bring back together and heal the planet, so that in seven generations, my my people from then could look back and see that I did something to make a change, to make a
Beautiful.
Change in the great turning that the world is on right now. So.
Well, Leroy, we are out of time, and I'm going to have you back again sometime because there's more ground to cover. But thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you. And you have a wonderful day, David.
I will, and you do the same. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.